Welcome back to Psychiatry Bootcamp. Today's topic is substance use disorder. And as you will hear, sometimes this psychiatric diagnosis gets split from other psychiatric diagnoses. And I think this happens both in a clinical sense when we work through our interview and in a forensic sense where statutes often specifically differentiate between substance use disorder and other forms of mental illness. And we'll talk a little bit about that in this episode. What is not surprising to anyone is how common and pervasive substance use disorder is. According to the 2021 Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration survey, in the United States, 46.3 million people ages 12 and older met the applicable DSM-5 criteria for having a substance use disorder in the past year. That's 16.5% of the population. Further, in 2017, Pew Research found that 46% of people had a family member or close friend affected by problematic substance use. And I'm just going to personally wager that this number is an underestimate in our post-pandemic and much more cannabis-forward world of 2023. Substance use disorder not only leads to negative outcomes for the person experiencing it, but as with many of our other psychiatric diagnoses, can really deeply impact a family system, and indeed, entire communities, as we've seen with the widely publicized opioid epidemic. When looking for an expert for this topic, I reached out to my friend Joseph Skrzydziewski, who works at the Hazelden Betty Ford Foundation, and I asked him if he could recommend a guest that was not only intelligent, but also animated and entertaining, and boy, did he deliver. Welcome to Dr. Steve DeLisi, and Dr. DeLisi, I will ask you to introduce yourself to our audience.
Sure. Dr. Steve DeLisi, great to be on the podcast here. I am a psychiatrist and addiction medicine physician from Minnesota. I am the chief medical officer for Your Path, which is a rapid access to low barrier care treatment provider here in the Twin Cities of Minnesota. I also am on faculty as an adjunct faculty member for the Hazel and Betty Ford Graduate School. And then finally, I work on faculty for the University of California at Irvine's Addiction Medicine for Primary Care Fellowship Program.
A busy man. So I guess what I want to know first of all is, what do you really love about your work?
Yeah, that's a wonderful question. I've been in this field actually since my final chief resident year at Rush Medical Center in Chicago. It was during that chief residency year that a addiction psychiatrist reached out to me, and he became my mentor. I knew coming out of residency that half of my appointment in Chicago was going to be as the associate residency director. I love teaching. I have always had a foot in academia and education. But from a clinical perspective, I hadn't made the decision. And he ran an SUD treatment program, partial hospital, IOP, which is intensive outpatient. And they wanted to build out more co-occurring disorder programming for their patients. And so Dr. Dan Angris and I worked 5 years together and built a co-occurring disorders track that was based on dialectical behavioral therapy, mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, and a 12-step facilitation. So just wanted to kind of cover that as my background and kind of my development. So I love the ability to continue to teach and educate the next generation of physicians, nurse practitioners, as well as addiction counselors and postdoc psychology trainees. At the same time, I love the direct interaction with individuals who are suffering from substance use disorder. And one of my passions is utilizing what I call therapeutic neuroscience. Therapeutic neuroscience is well established in the field of pain and pain management, less so within substance use disorder, but being able to share what we know about the neuroscience and neurophysiology of substance use disorder, I find very therapeutic for my patients as well as their loved ones. And it gives them hope. It provides an understanding for situations that feel very illogical and chaotic. And if we understand brain function, it's not as bewildering. It's still complex. It is still difficult, and it still destroys people's lives and families. Don't get me wrong there. But by utilizing this information, I find that it really helps to ground people. And then finally, a passion of mine is to lower the barriers and lower the thresholds for people to receive the treatment. My career has shifted and evolved from a more abstinence-based approach to treatment, a more programmatic approach that we have this program, we have this curriculum, and people then engage with it or don't engage with it. What I've seen over the past 20 plus years of my career is a development and an understanding that we have to have multiple pathways to healing and recovery. And we need multiple on-ramps to get people into treatment. And so now I would say that while I remain a recovery-oriented addiction physician, I embrace all of the on-ramps to get someone, and I allow the individual to define and set their trajectory in terms of what does recovery mean to them. Another role that I serve is on the board and advisory committee for the Steve Rumler Hope Network, that here in Minnesota is our largest naloxone training and distribution nonprofit. And that has brought me into contact with a more harm reduction street outreach colleagues, and how harm reduction can meet people where they're at, but not leave them there. Come alongside and then walk with them as they proceed through a healing and recovery.
Yeah, I think people don't really care what you know until they know that you care, you know, and this is sort of a general therapeutic principle, right? Is like, it doesn't matter if I'm the best exposure and response prevention therapist in the world, if I don't have a good relationship with the patient, if they don't feel safe coming to my office, we're never going to make progress.
That is correct. And this patient population is amongst the most stigmatized and traumatized of the chronic illnesses. So across chronic disease, our health system does not do a good job of instilling that sense of safety. We tend to blame patients for either causing that chronic illness or not taking control of their, in quotes, lifestyle behaviors. And again, it's just a fundamental misunderstanding of neurobiology and neurocognitive functioning. At the top of that stigmatization tends to be individuals with substance use disorder. And so many of the patients that we serve also have deep-seated trauma histories. And so they actually come into our office expecting to be re-traumatized and guarded and defensive against that. And so one of the first tasks of anyone working in this field is to understand that we may not be judging or stigmatizing that individual, but they think we are because we are part of a system that institutionally has marginalized these individuals. And many of them have so many intersectionalities of marginalization and discrimination that has to be the first step. And so just as you said, that they need to know they're coming into a safe place and they're going to be cared for. And once that is established, then we can start the process of assessing and then treating.
Wonderful. And on the therapeutic neuroscience point, it strikes me that this is one area of psychiatry where the neuroscience is very firm. You know, it's not every disorder. We have some hypotheses out there with other disorders, but for substance use disorders, we have excellent animal models for this. We can study on a number of different levels. And this is really not up for debate anymore. We know the underlying neurobiology of this. We know how strong it is. And so we're really going to dive into that later. And I would encourage our listeners to consider, you know, oftentimes, our patients don't want to hear some long abstract lecture about the things that we learned in medical school. But in this case, it can be really destigmatizing and help someone to get some traction under their wheels.
I agree. Yes.
Okay, so we are including substance use disorder in kind of our common psychiatric so-called horses, along with major depressive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder. But often when we take a history, we're not taking the substance use history in the HPI. So it makes it kind of differently organized in our brain. Do you think substance use disorder is best conceptualized as a separate entity, or do you think it should be considered a psychiatric horse along with the primary mood, primary psychotic, primary anxiety disorders?
Yeah, I absolutely believe that it should be part of the psychiatric horses. The approach, putting it often in the social history component, is contributing to the implicit biases of cause and control. By putting it in the social history, it then infers that that's part of the social behavior of this individual. And it belies, again, those two central implicit biases that lead to stigmatization, that the person had some active causing of that illness and that they should have control, rather than identify and recognize it as a distinct disease entity that, as you said, has a clear neurobiological basis that has been well documented for several decades at this point, and we learn more each year. So without hesitation, that should be part of the horses, the primary assessment of psychiatric illness, and not part of the social history at all.
So what about this? So we're covering substance use disorder as sort of one like global entity, as opposed to covering each substance individually. Is that fair? Is there any context that you'd like to lay in that regard?
Yeah, I love the question. And right now, it is fair to the point that we're not at the level of sophistication in the field of substance use disorder treatment to appreciably differentiate with customized treatments and prognostic indicators across different use disorders. It is true now that we have FDA-approved medications for alcohol use disorder, opioid use disorder, nicotine use disorder, and that's a step in the right direction. But if you look at the treatment of different substance use disorders in general, they tend to be quite similar and quite the same. And you often will hear people say, one substance use disorder is the same as another substance use disorder. You need to treat them all the same. In many residential treatment settings, patients with different substance use disorders will be grouped together. And there are absolutely shared pathophysiologic underpinnings of all of the substance use disorders. But it is also not true that a methamphetamine or a stimulant use disorder is the same as an alcohol use disorder, or a cannabis use disorder being the same as an opioid use disorder. There are clear differences. The analogy that I use in talking about this is I feel that this field of substance use disorder is at the place where the oncology field was when we first elucidated some of the pathophysiology of cancers, that it went from that the person had some type of consumption or wasting disease to an identification of this is cancer and we have some biological and physiologic underpinnings. And so then we diagnosed it cancer. I think that substance use disorder is right at that point and is starting to emerge with the opportunity to say that the diagnoses of specific substance use disorders is going to lead to customized and specific treatments. And then when we have that, we've got the opportunity then to look at 3, 6, 12, 36, 60-month survival and outcome curves, similar again to our oncology colleagues. Oncology moved from making the diagnosis of the big C cancer to then subtyping different types of cancer. And with that, you started to see the specific treatment approaches. It has now moved to the point that within each of those subtypes of cancers, we now have genotype and phenotyping of the subsets of the subset. And without question, I see that in the future of substance use disorder. Now that we've got very effective medications like methadone and buprenorphine for opioid use disorder, we now are going to be looking at what are the genotypes and phenotypes of individual opioid use disorder, because not all opioid use disorder is the same for everybody else. And we can start to be more, even more specific. And I'm aware of studies that are being done across the country. Here in Minnesota, the Mayo Clinic is doing some genotyping around opioid use disorder in response to the FDA-approved medication. So I'm really excited about that.
Yeah, so the brain's kind of often called the last frontier, you know, in our biological sciences, our life sciences. And so our listeners can look forward to a lot of things evolving throughout the course of their career. So hopefully if we were to re-record this in 50 years, you know, we'd have a lot different information. And your point about all use disorders not being the same is just, it's almost clinical common sense, right? We can think about the patients that we see that struggle with these issues, and it's just so clear to us that substance use disorder is not a monolith.
That's correct. Yes.
Okay. So here's sort of like the question, I think, for some people. Where do we draw the line between what might be considered normal substance use, substance misuse, and substance use disorder, that is addiction?
Yes, that's a fabulous question. And right now, what we have to offer in terms of an answer to that are the DSM-5 criteria. It's not hard science. It's not a brain scan. It's not a blood test, right? And that still remains elusive across most of psychiatry. But we do have very clear indications that if we start to see 3, 4, 5 of the DSM-5 criteria, we're moving in the direction of substance use and misuse that is clearly impacting the individual's living and functioning. And again, across most of our psychiatric diagnoses, that's what it is about. It is a constellation of symptoms that define, if you will, a syndrome, and it has clear impact with functional impairment. What does that mean? It means that the set point for that diagnosis is often different for different people. And none of us in the field are satisfied by that. This takes us back to, again, the work that is being done at the neurobiological level to identify the underpinnings of where is that line? Where does that exist? And for me, the studies that exist that are currently not clinically relevant, but are at the basic science and the bench and non-human studies providing some answers are the studies that look at the functioning of the ventrotegmental area, the nucleus accumbens, the speed at which dopamine transmission is working within that reward pathway. We know that the nucleus accumbens encodes for faster and higher increases in dopamine release from the ventrotegmental area. It encodes that as more important for well-being and survival. It's a probability calculator. It doesn't evaluate that signal. It doesn't assess whether that is a valid and reliable measure of being important for well-being and survival, but it encodes for that. we know that we can test for and see how much each of the substances is releasing dopamine in that response, as well as the differences that different patient populations will have in response to those rewards. So I think that's an important piece in terms of where can we draw the line. And then a really big area of interest to me, both clinically, academically, and with research, is the functioning of the prefrontal cortex and its ability to regulate our reward mechanisms and our emotions within that limbic system. And that too is I think, a neurobiological line in the a diagnosis, that as you see less and less executive functioning control of motivation, drive, reward, and emotions, that often is one of the neurobiological underpinnings across a lot of our psychiatric illnesses, including substance use disorder.
Well, you've blown my mind. I did not think that was going to occur on this episode, but the idea that we could actually quantify, you know, how quickly that dopamine transition is happening and maybe draw a line somewhere, that's just amazing to me. That gets me really excited. With regards to your comment on the DSM being clinical constructs, I just have to direct our listeners here. If you have not listened to episode one on the DSM yet, after this episode, please go do that. I think you'll find it really fruitful. Dr. DeLisi, you mentioned the projections from the ventrotegmental area to the nucleus accumbens, delivering that dopamine. You mentioned that in substance use disorders, the ability to regulate the limbic system coming from the frontal lobe is impaired. Are there any other elements of that neurobiology that you think would be helpful for our listeners to know?
Yeah, I love that question, because this is kind of central to a lot of the trainings and lectures that I give. So we can understand the processes around the general substance use disorder. So this is where we take a step back and we say, what is shared in common? And from the work of Dr. Nora Volkow from NIDA, Dr. George Koob from the NIAAA, from some of the neurocognitive work of Dr. Mark Lewis and Dr. Miller here at the University of Minnesota, we can understand what is happening neurobiologically through three major phases or stages in the development of substance use disorder. That first stage is that the initial reinforcer, what we often call the reward from the substance use disorder. Often we get fixated on the high or the euphoria. And this is where you will sometimes actually hear people talk about the reward pathway as the pleasure center, and that dopamine is the, in quotes, feel good chemical. I take issue with that, as it focuses too much on hedonistic tone and chasing, in quotes, the high. And that absolutely is part of individual substance use disorder histories. You will hear that first time that I ever used, I felt incredible. I felt great. I felt better than I'd ever felt in my entire life. And I've tried to chase that. That you do hear. And that is one of the reinforcers of these substances. And rewards that encode for survival sometimes are rewarding in that way. But that does not define the reinforcement of substance use disorder and continued use for the vast majority of individuals that I have spent 25 years serving and caring with and for. Much more often, I hear that the reinforcer is around moderating, reducing, or dulling pain, be it physical pain or psychic emotional pain. And here, the use will be described as it takes away the depression. I don't feel that overwhelming anxiety, doom, and dread. I don't experience panic attacks. I'm able to sleep. And I don't have the images or the memories of past abuse that reoccur. And for a brief period of time, I just don't feel. That is often what is reinforcing. And then the other third major reinforcement that substances can trigger is that of a sense of a human attachment and connection. And here you will hear people describe that when they have first started to use or when there is a return to use, that there's an overwhelming sense of belonging or connection that they haven't experienced previously in their lifetime or elsewhere, that they feel a sense of belonging, a sense of warmth that comes around them. Sometimes they will even state that when they first used, it was as if they were being held, hugged, or embraced by that substance, which I think is immensely profound. Because from a neurobiological perspective, one of the triggers for the release of our own beta endorphins is touch. Mammalian research has demonstrated that oxytocin and beta endorphins often work synergistically to enhance and maintain a sense of connection and attachment. And when you start to think about the reward pathway as the survival pathway, you start to understand why oxytocin and mu opioid receptors are expressed throughout this entire system and directly regulate dopamine neurotransmission. Because humans are not the most well-adapted species for planet Earth. We're not the strongest. We're not the fastest. We don't have the best immune system. Rearing our offspring takes decades to achieve. Therefore, from the very earliest moments of life, there needs to be the reinforcement, the reward of being in fellowship and connection with other humans. Because if we were like many other animals where the offspring is born and then essentially fends for itself from birth, we, again, it's decades in that process. And any of us who have parented, I've got three 20-something-year-old boys, parenting is wonderfully rewarding, but incredibly challenging. And so this neurobiological mechanism of attachment and connection is inextricably linked with survival. And so when mammalian studies have been done, licking, petting, grooming, intercourse, all trigger the dopamine or the opioid-mediated dopamine limbic system. And the same can be said for humans. The issue with opioids, which directly activate the opioid receptors, that's what they do. Heavy drinking, heavy binge episodes of drinking releases endorphins. And as we learn more about a stimulant use disorder, we are seeing indirect effects on this opioid system. And for me, that plays into the reason why we see at a societal level these stark increases in alcohol use, opioid use, stimulant use. And we saw spikes in all of those during the pandemic when we had the lockdown and we were social distancing. Again, we needed a social distance. We needed to have that separation. But for the most sensitive and the most at risk of our neighborhoods, our family, our friends, that physical distance, that lack of touch decreased that endogenous trigger of the mu opioid system. And I don't think it's by any mistake coincidence. That's what I'm looking for. It was no coincidence that we saw increases in the substances that would most target that attachment connection mechanism within this reward system. Finally, I would say, you know, think about what I said earlier about our patients often having a trauma and issues around attachment and connection. Their earliest memories often of human fellowship was traumatizing and abusive. So they are guarded and defended against that. then they are exposed to one of these substances, and this mechanism is activated for the first time. So in a very real sense, many of our patients are attached to their substance in the same way that we might be attached to the most loving relationships in our lives. And when we are engaging in the early stages of treatment, if we don't understand that, we will miss the fact that we are asking them to disattach with something that is really important to them. And what are we replacing that with? And how are we teaching them to trust humans when their experience has been one of hurt? So those are some of the immediate things that I wanted to share on this podcast. There are a lot of other mechanisms that we can look at in terms of the neurobiology of the second phase of a substance use disorder, that being withdrawal and negative affect. And so as someone is continuing to use substances, their entire neurobiology is being downregulated. So if they're using opioids, that mu opioid receptor is being downregulated across all substances. The dopamine system is going to be downregulated. And so then when the use is disrupted, tolerance has been built up, physiologic dependence has resulted, and the person experiences withdrawal, negative emotion, negative affect. And that can be a potent trigger to both cravings for a return to use, but also a re-traumatization for those individuals that, again, have a trauma history. Physiologic withdrawal symptoms mimic the fight, flight, freeze, or fawn of neurobiology. And so if you've got that trauma history, it feels like you're in the FFF. And so the person is either going to fight or is going to flee or is going to just freeze or fawn. And you see that. You absolutely see that. You see people getting more agitated, more irritable, more combative, if you will. It's not that they're a difficult person who is wanting to push you away. It's that they are a traumatized individual having their trauma re-triggered, and we need to be receptive to that. It's also what often results in people fleeing treatment and then not returning. And again, if we don't think that, we'll just think, yeah, they just wanted to go use again, and they were wanting to chase the high. And I hear that, I've heard that my entire career. And as I look back on my career, many more of the individuals were being triggered with their trauma, and they were going into a defensive mechanism. They were utilizing their survival skills. And it was right at that moment that we could have had such an impact if we had recognized that. And then let me just finish with the last phase or stage that Dr. Bolkow and Koop speak about. And that's the craving anticipation phase. This is where the individual is consumed cognitively with, what am I going to use next? Where am I going to use next? How am I going to use next? With whom am I going to use next? And oftentimes that plays into the cause and control biases that we talked about earlier, because people will say, listen, if they can work and figure out how to find the drugs, why are they not working and making the effort to find and stay in treatment? And it's a fundamental misunderstanding of the neurobiology, because that capacity for choice and agency resides in the prefrontal cortex, the very front part of our brain, that which is most developed in humans. It's our executive functioning area of the brain. In a substance use disorder, and again, where you ask me, where do you draw the line? Here's one of them. When I see executive functioning deficits, and when I see that instead of the prefrontal cortex regulating the limbic system, I now see the limbic system regulating the prefrontal cortex, that's substance use disorder. And what you see there is that the limbic system is driving and sending projections to the prefrontal cortex to say, listen, you're the problem-solving part of the brain. We need you to figure out when, how, with whom, and where we're going to use next. It's not the prefrontal cortex doing that of their own accord. And so in a substance use disorder, we call that insidious role reversal, cravings, or preoccupation. A parallel for our patients who have significant co-occurring depression, anxiety, other co-occurring psychiatric illnesses, we will often see that same role reversal, but in depression, anxiety, we often call that rumination. And rumination being the driving of the prefrontal cortex by the limbic system, predominantly areas like the amygdala, to figure out how, when, where we can not feel the depression or the anxiety. And you just have that squirrel that is in the mind. It's a very similar squirrel. In one, we call it rumination. The other, we call it cravings. So long-winded answer, but that's what I got for you.
No, it's all brilliant. I'm sure our listeners are like, Mark, just stop talking. Just let him keep going. So I love evolutionary psychiatry. I try to take that approach where I can. And this is a very evolutionary phenomenon that you're talking about. These are our most base instinct as human beings. Behavior, yes. reward, things that should get rewards, scavenging for food, having sex and reproducing, you know, finding shelter, very basic things. And in substance use disorder, these very basic human instincts are not working the way they should, which means in treatment of substance use disorder, we've got to really roll up our sleeves and get our hands dirty because we're talking about trying to sort of reprogram what are aberrant, very basic human instincts.
I love that call out, Mark. And your listeners are definitely not wanting you to shut up because your questions are all on point. And we are talking about basic evolutionary drives that are being usurped and hijacked when we talk about substance use disorders. This is where I love the work of Dr. Mark Lewis. And a lot of times people will read Mark Lewis and that group as kind of in opposition to, if you will, the Nora Volkow, George Kuba group. And if you go back in the mid-2000s, there were actually a couple of review articles published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And the NIDA group, the title was something to the effect of substance use disorders as brain disease. And the Mark Lewis review article was substance use disorder, learning and memory, not brain disease. And I have those two as reading assignments in my biological perspectives course for a master's prepared addiction counselors to look at it because they're both fabulous for their time, neurobiological reviews. What's different is the interpretation of the data. I take a both and perspective. I do subscribe to substance use disorders emerging as a illness, a disease entity with a neurophysiology, but it is absolutely linked to learning and memory. And if we don't believe that, then what are we doing in terms of all of our interventions that are not pharmacologic? All of our evidence-based psychotherapeutic interventions for substance use disorder are predicated on the individuals to do learning and memory and to modulate and adapt to those systems. So it's super important. But in active substance use disorder, and I want to also introduce that for individuals who are genetically at higher risk of developing a substance use disorder, and those individuals who have epigenetic risk factors. And this is where we start to talk about the literature coming out of the adverse childhood experiences studies. We know that individuals who have extensive trauma history in childhood or four or more adverse childhood experiences, they will often have lower baseline dopamine release in the nucleus accumbens in this reward system. They have functional and structural changes to their amygdala. They often have a decreased baseline beta endorphin release and lower release of the beta endorphins and dopamine to the, if you will, natural reinforcers. I mean, so this would be that the individual comes into your office and says, you know, before I used, I never understood or experienced what my friends would experience when something good happened. Like I would see them get a new job or do well on a test or start a family, buy a house. And I would see this excitement and I would see their reward. And I never felt that. I always kind of feel blah and everything was blunted. And then I used X, Y, or Z for the first time. And I was like, oh, this is what everybody experienced, right? Well, if that's the case, then that first use, going back to the very first use, that is not the same experience as someone who does not have those same genetic and epigenetic risk factors. And so a lot of times I'll review the neurobiology and people will say, Steve, you convinced me. Once someone has a substance use disorder, choice, cause, control, as we know it, don't pertain. But that first time, they did choose that first time. And then that's when I have to back them up, share what I just shared with you about some of the genetic and epigenetic differences. And then I add that both within medicine and the education field, there is a good body of research that shows that kids who have come from abusive homes have a high ACEs score or are in communities that have been historically and generationally marginalized and neglected, that haven't had the resiliency and some positive experiences that some marginalized communities have created. And their use of substances is actually lower than would be predicted by what I am talking about. But in many others, that those historical and generational traumas, the social determinants of health that we focus on, those all contribute to a delay in the development of the prefrontal cortex. And we know that within medicine and healthcare research, but academia education is looking at that too, because it affects the ability of kids to regulate their behaviors in school. You know, you think about it and the way that we structure school requires and rewards kids who have a early development of executive functioning. And the kids that delay in that often end up, you know, being termed difficult or behavioral disordered, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Some of that is just a delay in their development of the prefrontal cortex. And we know that prefrontal cortex doesn't fully delay into our, you know, until our 20s, right? So that is going to happen then. But if you superimpose these adversities without a corresponding resilience or positivity, there's often a further delay in that development. And that's the executive functioning. That's the computer, if you will, that is saying, hey, yes, I experienced that dopamine rush with the cocaine or the binge alcohol, but it's not actually the most important thing to our well-being and survival. And like, the last two times that we used it didn't go well for us. That is predicated on a fully functioning prefrontal cortex. And if that's not yet been established, that's not going to be there. And so then, as I said before, that which is seemingly chaotic and illogical starts to make sense when you think to yourself, okay, this part of the brain is looking for those spikes in dopamine. And this is where more and faster rules the road. It's not just an increase in dopamine. It's the amplitude of increase in dopamine at the nucleus accumbens and how fast that happens. That's why heroin is more reinforcing than methadone. Heroin fast, methadone slow. I mean, that makes appreciable difference. When we look at relative releases of dopamine, when you and I woke up today to get up and going and send signals to our basal ganglia, the dorsal striatum, globus pallidus, to get that motor going, right? We had a pulsatile release of dopamine of about 50 nanograms per deciliter being released into the nucleus accumbens, just that baseline. If you've had a, if you woke up and you're having a bad day and you're dragging yourself to get moving, you might be sitting at 30 nanograms per deciliter. If you're having a particularly good day, you might be sitting at 60 or 70 and you're like, I'm ready, let's go, right? That's our baseline. When we eat, when we have a food, that will spike the dopamine. Studies have shown maybe 60 to 70 nanograms per deciliter. So that's above that baseline. When we have sex, physical intimacy, 100 to 150 nanograms per deciliter. So 2 to 3 times the baseline. But when someone uses something like heroin, over 800 nanograms per deciliter are released. And methamphetamine is close to 1,200. And all addictive substances release supraphysiologic. So that's going to be that primary signal. And that's why, to go back to your point, from an evolutionary standpoint, that's why our patient is seemingly choosing the drug over food and work and school and family, because none of those are triggering to that same effect, and the prefrontal cortex is not correcting it. The prefrontal cortex does a lot of evaluating the amplitude of a reward, the accuracy of a reward, the reliability of a reward, and holding that reward over time. You have to have a prefrontal cortex working to do all of those tasks. It's one of the reasons why we see individuals with a substance use disorder or at higher risk for a substance use disorder. They will often demonstrate a lack of ability to delay gratification before they ever pick up a substance. And neurocognitively, that's studied by assessing how long do they hold the value of a reward over time. And if it stays a long period of time, you can delay gratification. Pursuing a career in medicine, you got the ability to delay gratification because you have to delay gratification for many, many years. Individuals where that value decays rapidly, the only way you get the reinforcement is if you get the reward immediately. So,
lot to unpack there. So regarding the increases in dopamine, if any of our listeners have not looked at this bar graph, get out your phone right now and Google it. My jaw hit the floor at first. I'll never forget that. I was like, oh, duh, you know?
Yeah.
And then to your point about the prefrontal cortex is not developed, that's the very neurobiological, et cetera. You know, you're very at risk for this sort of a thing in adolescence as you're growing. Take it to a more spiritual level. You mentioned belonging. I love Absolutely. That example of some people, when they use, they get this sensation of, oh, this is what everybody else feels like. And we can't really fault people for wanting to feel like anyone else. Anybody who's been Absolutely through adolescence, which I hope is everyone who's listening to this podcast, knows that there's nothing more you want at that stage of development than just to fit in, to be normal, to feel like everybody else. It's just such a human desire.
Absolutely. And I do subscribe to that when you're sitting down with another human being, we are, as humans, biopsychosocial and spiritual, that all of those, and they're not in silos. So I have clearly spoken most around the bio part, but there is most definitely an interaction with the psychology, with the socialization, and with our spirituality. And there's no question, there's a wonderful body of research looking at on the difficult side, the effects of grief, loss, and loneliness on humans. And on the positive side, the whole literature of positive psychology, the positive emotions and love and what it can do for the healing of an individual. And that absolutely has also been something that has evolved as I've gone through my career, and more comfort in speaking of spirituality and speaking of love. And I'm unapologetic in saying that when you have a safe consumption site staffed by individuals who are welcoming individuals into that place and holding them in that place of safety and security, that is demonstrating the respect of that other human being and that love and positive regard. And I think that that's part of why, when you look at the studies of safe consumption sites and syringe access sites, that there is an increased uptick of pursuing other aspects of treatment and getting into a life of recovery without substances. It's a markedly higher percentage than the general population. And I think it has to do with a fundamental need of humans is to know and be known, see and be seen. And when my colleagues who work in those settings are knowing and seeing people as people, it has an impact.
Well, we're going to have you back on at some point, because it's just amazing the depth of understanding that you're bringing to this topic. So let's really dive into some clinical information that can help our learners as they go see these patients. So when we're taking a history from a patient or discussing substance use, any best practices, tips that you would recommend?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm going to go back to our earlier conversation. It starts with establishing the rapport and that sense of trust and safety. So how do you do that? Some of it is what is presented in the waiting room and in your office in terms of resources that respect and recognize that people are going to be coming to you at all different stages of change. And for me, different stages of cognitive capacity to change. There's the stages of change that we all know, but you also have to assess what's their capacity to change. If they don't have executive functioning, they are going to need high structure and support to do any aspects of the treatment plan. So what do you have in the waiting room that speaks to resources and supports within the community that speak to all of the different on-ramps of treatment, that recognizes and acknowledges that so many of our patients touch so many intersectionalities of discrimination and marginalization. So we have to over-communicate before we even open our mouth that we understand that them being in the office is a level of courage and bravery beyond, I'll say it for myself, beyond what I can comprehend. My wisdom of lived experience is not of a substance use disorder. It is of depression and anxiety. So I bring that lived experience into the work that I do. But I did not experience the marginalization that my patients with use disorders have. So I need to make sure that they know I know, and I am communicating that. So that's it begins before we ever lay eyes on the person or open our mouths. That's number one. Number two is that when we do start to talk, we initiate the conversation to get to know the person as another human being. Like the first question isn't, why are you here? And then we write down because they're concerned about their alcohol use disorder, and then we do the cage and the audit. That's not going to feel safe for the individual. So first be human and say, really glad to see you today. Wanna ask you a series of questions. I've got a lot of questions for you. But first, I just want to understand what led to you picking up the phone and then getting yourself here today? And then I just listen for a few minutes. For most patients, it's just a couple minutes. They can't tolerate much more. Of course, there are going to be the other individuals where 15 minutes later, you're trying to find a way to get a word in edgewise. But just let them tell a little bit of that piece of the story. Start building that rapport. When it's been identified that some of the concern and the issue is around substance use, then it is my next question is not going to be about going through the DSM-5 criteria in all classes of substances. I'll get there. That is part of a thorough assessment. But earlier on, I love to ask the individual, can you tell me the story of what you experienced the first two times you used? And then I'll go in order of the things that are most connected to that individual. So if it's someone who's coming in and they're expressing concern about current fentanyl use, I would have heard in their history, or I might have to ask a clarifying question, where did the use first start and with what? Because I want that information, but I'm not going to really go into the weeds yet. I then want to ask them, let's say they say it was they had a prescription of Percocet or they got perks on the street. I will ask them to tell me the story of the first couple of times they used that Percocet specifically. And then I just listen. And that often takes 5-10 minutes. But in those 5 and 10 minutes, I get the diagnosis. I can do the DSM-5. And I also am able to put into one of those or one or more of those three buckets that I talked about, euphoria reinforcement, pain reduction reinforcement, or attachment, so that I have a fundamental understanding of what this human was reinforced as it pertained to the substances. And then from that, I have a much more thorough understanding of what we're dealing with.
We're talking about the underlying cause here.
That is exactly. The underlying cause that led to it, it gives me information on the biology, gives me information on the psychology, the social aspects, and oftentimes I start to hear things that are more spiritual. And it also starts to inform my initial assessment and treatment plan, because those initial reinforcements are going to come back and are going to be the most important variables for a recovery management plan to reduce the risk of a reemergence of symptoms and a return to use. And I use that language intentionally because that's the next step that I wanted to share with all of your listeners. Our language is crucial. As a healthcare professional, if you don't listen to any other aspects of my rambling answers today, this one you got to lock in. You are never neutral in terms of moving someone towards or away from engagement in the treatment process. As a healthcare professional, as a physician or other healthcare physician, because of who you are never neutral. Don't ever say, well, I only had 5 minutes. I only talked with them for like 3 minutes in the ED. Doesn't matter. Does not matter. You either move them a little bit away because you didn't engage in those 3 minutes and they're like, well, see, that person didn't care. They gave me 3 minutes and I could tell they weren't listening for any of those 3 minutes. You've moved them away. Or in those 3 minutes, you got to their eye level. You sat down in the chair while they were in that ED bed and you looked them in the eye and you listened to them for 3 minutes. You've now moved them towards engagement. And the language matters. Asking someone, you don't use meth, do you? Not likely to get any useful information. It equally not useful is looking down at your computer or notepad and saying, how much methamphetamine did you use in the past week? Versus, again, looking them in the eye and say, in this past week, did you use any methamphetamine? in this past week, how many drinks did you have? In this past week, did you use marijuana, cannabis, weed? So that you're telling them, I know people use these substances, and I'm going to start with this week, and I'm going to quantify, and then I'm going to go from there. That's how you want to ask it. You need to watch your judgmental. We don't have clean and dirty urines. We have urines that are positive for specific substances. And then we need to say, and this was an expected result or unexpected result, because positive and negative are not sufficient. If someone is positive for a metabolite of diazepam and they were just in a medical withdrawal management a few days ago, of course. If they've got compromised liver or they're older, they're going to have diazepam metabolites for a long, long time. So we want to say positive, but that's expected, or negative, and that's either expected or, if they are reporting that they haven't used that substance, or it might be unexpected if what's negative is buprenorphine and norbuprenorphine. That would be unexpected in a patient who's being prescribed buprenorphine. So those kind of language changes. And then if you noticed when I talked about developing a recovery management plan, I did not call it a relapse prevention plan. And I said that what we were developing was a plan to promote ongoing recovery and a reduction in return to use or reemergence of symptoms. Relapse, when we talk about relapse, which is embedded in our field, it's going to take generation to get this language shifted. But I've got an opportunity to talk with all of you, and I'm going to encourage you, don't use the term relapse. Describe what it is. And it is a reemergence of the chronic use disorder that you've diagnosed. The same as seeing an elevation in a hemoglobin A1C as evidencing the reemergence of active diabetes, and we've got to change the treatment plan to address that. We tend not to say, I have not heard many people say that a patient with diabetes has relapsed on donuts and has had a dirty hemoglobin A1C. I just have not heard that, right? But it's the same principle from a health professional component. And so I just challenge us. Also, when you say that someone has relapsed, where is the subject of that verb relapse? If I say Jim relapsed with cocaine, where is the agency, the, if you will, fall? Where is the cause of that relapse with cocaine? Jim relapsed with cocaine. Now, if I say Jim has had a reemergence of symptoms of his cocaine use disorder as evidenced by a return to use, now the agency is on the cocaine use disorder. It fundamentally, you will absolutely see the change in your patient's eyes and whole countenance when you word it that way. Because they're going to come in as I have failed again and shame-based if they're coming and saying, you know, Mark, I relapsed again. Now, if I say, oh, yeah, I, you know, relapse is a part of this disease and you relapsed again and we'll work on your relapse prevention, I have completely colluded with you to blame you for that situation. As compared to me saying, you know, Mark, I hear what you're saying. First, let me start by saying I really appreciate that you came in and told me about this return to use. I also want you to recognize that's actually recovery in action. That's healing in action. The fact you're sitting in my office, I'm guessing you weren't too excited to make this appointment, but you pushed through that and you're telling me that you had this return to use. The way I hear it, you've had a reemergence of symptoms of your cocaine use disorder. Really no different than if one of my patients has an increase in their blood pressure when we know that they have high blood pressure, or they have an asthma attack and we know that they have asthma. It's really no different than that. Now, I recognize that your life has been spun upside down. Your spouse is urias, you might lose your job. Like I'm not missing the impact of this reemergence of symptoms, Mark, but let's look at that and let's see how are we going to work together to adjust your treatment plan so that we can have a less chance of this happening in the future. That fundamental, let me ask you, like in just that role play, how did those two versions to you sound to you?
Oh my gosh. Well, I'm certainly a lot more likely to stay in treatment when you destigmatize it that way. Our patients beat themselves up enough. They don't need us to pile on.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So that, you know, that's how I approach that initial assessment. And I think that if your listeners adopt some of this and approach it in that way and have that mindset of I'm meeting this individual where they're at, I'm not going to leave them there. I'm going to continue to work at moving them along the trajectory of their recovery and healing, but I'm going to meet them where they're at. It's really helpful to use destigmatizing language and maintain that eye contact and connection. Motivational interviewing skills and tools absolutely come into play, critically important. That's going to dominate the early stages because, again, we're never neutral. And so we want to continue to move them towards that agency of making the changes and adhering to treatment plans that they're capable of doing. This is also where understanding that if they're showing signs of executive functioning deficit, they're not objectively able to assess themselves, poor judgment across multiple domains, not learning from past experiences. Like when I first sit down with someone like Bill, I'm sitting there saying, you know, what don't you get? Like everybody in your life and me after like 10 minutes knows that when you pick up cocaine again, it's not going to go well, right? That's my old Steve, right? And what did I just say? He's actively picking up. And so I'm blaming the patient and I'm getting very frustrated. What happens when I verbally or non-verbally communicate that frustration? They pick it up. They're going to perceive that as a threat. That's not going to feel safe. If Bill has a trauma history, FFF, right? Fight, flight, or freeze. I'm also looking, do they have poor attention span? Are they easily bored? Are they frequently argumentative, thin-skinned, self-centered, right? All of those last terms I'm using for this podcast would not describe that a patient that way in my notes. But a lot of times when someone has a prefrontal disconnect, executive functioning deficits, that's how they will present. And I share that because sometimes it feels like we're walking on eggshells, that we're, in quotes, working harder than the patient. And frequently that also frustrates or upsets a clinician. And that can then be perceived. It also can be where we get so frustrated that we start to experience compassion fatigue or empathetic distress. And if we have a series of those over and over again, and we're not pulling back to check our own reactions, that leads to burnout. So this is important for the patient, but it's also important for everybody listening in. Right-sizing our understanding of what's going on and being able to say to ourselves, oh, Bill doesn't have the executive functioning that I'm expecting him to have. He's going to be more argumentative. And as I try to do really good motivational interviewing and I'm giving him that menu of options for him to choose, in a deficit state, Bill is going to shoot down every single one of those options as being stupid, or he's tried it and it hasn't worked. It's not that Bill is a difficult person. It's that he is not functioning in full capacity. So let's sit with that and recognize it as part of the symptom cluster of the illness, again, that we've signed up to treat.
Okay. So I think what you're getting at with compassion fatigue is to be an effective healer in psychiatry, it's not going to work if we are an emotional bubble boy. You know, we can't just repel all the emotions that our patients have. We have skin in the game, you know, own it. We have skin in the game. And so we have to talk to ourselves this way, conceptualize things this way, communicate with our patients this way, because that is how we can be an effective healer.
Correct.
And that's really what you've been talking about this whole time, is kind of how to have a deeper understanding of these patients. I actually love that we didn't just kind of list through the DSM criteria, list through the FDA approved medications. That will take you literally 15 seconds.
Exactly.
We're talking about the underlying cause here, getting to know people and changing people's lives. Dr. DeLisi, you've been so, so helpful for us to understand this. Do you have any final thoughts for our listeners?
Well, first, let me just thank you for this opportunity. Love the podcast and love this opportunity to share this information and to encourage all the listeners to really take a look at how they're approaching the individual with a substance use disorder, as well as to reflect upon themselves and to understand and to know they also need to have healing, wholeness, well-being. I have had too many colleagues who have experienced burnout, severe depressions, and I've had four of my colleagues who have died by suicide. And so I think my final word is going to be to the healers and the clinicians listening to pay attention to your own needs, to pursue what you need to pursue, and don't hesitate to reach out to colleagues, friends, and family. This work is difficult. It is also doable if we don't try to do it alone. So find that group of colleagues, find that mentor, find a supervisor that's not just part of training, but is someone that you can do curbside consults with, and make sure that your own needs are being met as you meet the needs and serve the patients that we've been talking about. They need you, but they need you coming from a place of wholeness and wellness. Thanks a lot, Mark.
Thank you. Hope to have you back.
Anytime.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Psychiatry Bootcamp. Special thanks to the Behavioral Health Education Center of Nebraska for their support. If you have any questions or feedback for me, you can email me at psychiatrybootcamppodcast@gmail.com or reach out to me on Twitter. Of course, this podcast is not intended to be used as medical advice or in any legal proceedings whatsoever, including to establish a standard of care. This podcast is intended only as a supplement to a complete accredited psychiatry residency and is grossly inadequate to rely on for medical decision making. It is intended to entertain and inform. You should always rely on your own clinical judgment when making medical decisions, and contact your physician for medical advice.